using the larger sizes, but the smaller sizes are very difficult to roll by a machine, and they're still rolled by hand, as I understand it. Instruments also were bought by number, the number from 1 to 12. The number didn't mean very much. You would buy a half a dozen sizes of, let's say, number 6 in one box. And just looking at the box, looking at the reamers or files in the box, you could tell that there is a variation macroscopically. And it was not until the standardized sizes came out that we really got somewhere insofar as having instruments of definite sizes and tapers. And for this, we must give credit to my good friend John Engel and Pierre Dow. They reported the use of standardized instruments, as I recall, at the first International Conference on Endodontics, which was held at the University of Pennsylvania. And this was a great advance.
Now, you touched on a subject that I want to get into. You've touched on a lot of subjects that I'd like to get into. Would you relate how you came upon the idea of putting together an international conference and what difficulties you had in doing it, especially internationally? And also, I'd be very interested in learning about your relationship with Dr. Nygodowski.
Yeah. Well, if I remember correctly, the first international conference was held in 53. And I believe, in fact, I know that the first Federation Dentaire Internationale was held in London perhaps just 2 or 3 years prior to that time. I was an official lecturer on endodontics at this meeting, and looking through the program, I found that Birger Nygaard-Osby was on the program. I had not only heard of him, but I had his book, which was really a thesis for PhD, which he had published. I obtained this through the good graces of Radar Sognes, Sognes. And I was very much impressed by his work. And so I looked him up at the meeting where he lectured, and I was impressed by his presentation. Right then and there, I invited him to the first International Conference on Endodontics. And he agreed to come. I was acquainted with the work of Pucci, P-U-C-C-I, of Montevideo, Uruguay. He had published a two-volume book on the anatomy of the root canals of the teeth. Conductos radiculares. And although I do not know Spanish, the illustrations were so beautiful that I was greatly impressed. And I wrote and invited him to the conference, and some others from England, etc., etc. The conference paid its way and a little bit beyond that. And so we were able to have other conferences after that.
Where did the original funds come from to support the conference?
Dr. Appleton, whom I mentioned earlier, with whom I worked in the field of microbiology, became dean. And because of our close relationship, the school was willing to fund it. And that was a great help, because I'm sure I couldn't have obtained help elsewhere.
Let me digress a little bit more. I know that Dr. Ospie had a profound effect on the course of endodontics in this country, just from a biologic standpoint versus, say, the chemical standpoint.
That was empiric.
Empiric, right. Could you go into that a little bit, at what treatment was like at the times? I realize that Philadelphia was a center of endodontic treatment, Michigan was a center of endodontic treatment, and obviously Ospie came over with a different approach to the whole picture also. Could you get into that?
Well, his work was primarily in the field of periapical pathology, and he tried to relate that with the history of the patient, the size and kind, type of lesion, etc., etc. Later on, he suggested the possibility of irritating the periapical tissue so as to produce bleeding. He had hoped that in this manner we could obtain an apical seal. He wrote a paper suggesting this. He treated a number of cases by this method, but a number of years later, he reversed his opinion as to the success of this type of an operation. He is responsible for the introduction of EDTAC in the field of endodontics. He gave lectures and courses in this country, in various parts of this country, apart from lecturing at the AAE meeting or meetings. He was the head of the research institute, Dental Research Institute, in Oslo, Norway, which was not connected with the dental school. It was an independent research investigative body. He is responsible for having, as a student, Carl Langland, at the present time, forget his name, Molven, first name, Molven, M-O-L-V-E-N, runs through my mind someone else was nurtured there of prominence, but the object was to carry out research in the field of endodontics.
What type of dynamism or dynamic personality was Ospie to be able to carry his philosophy to the United States and almost relish in being Americanized?
Yes. Well, Ospie was a very dynamic person, as I'm sure you know. He left his home as a young man and became a sailor. He sailed down to South America and remained a sailor for I can't recall how many years, but I'm sure it was for more than 1 year. I don't know when he actually began to study dentistry, but he was very fluent in languages. He could speak quite fluently in German, French, Italian, beside the Norwegian languages. He was the first person who went to mainland China on behalf of WHO to study what dentistry was like in China. John Ingle, I think, in this country was, or I should say John Ingle, was the first from this country to study endodontic treatment there. But I think you hit the nail on the head when you refer to Birger. I call him by his first name, his first given name, but most of the people called him Bill or Uncle Bill, affectionately. And he was a great person. Anyone who knew him just loved him.
That's what I understand. I also...
I might mention, amongst the early dental greats, I knew two others. One was J. Roy Blaney, who also taught in Chicago, and who made an evaluation probably in the early 20s that and found that underfilling or underfilled root canals had a better success rate than overfilled root canals. I also knew E.H. Hatton, a pathologist, who defended root canal treatment in the days when it needed defending. I also knew, and this goes back a great many years, I also knew one of the early greats in dentistry, namely Meyer L. Rhein, R-H-E-I-N, after whom the Rhein pick is named. He lectured at our, in fact, he was on the faculty of our school, and when I was a student, he came in to give a special lecture on root canal treatment.
I believe he produced the earliest film on endodontics, if I'm not mistaken.
No, the earliest film on endodontics was produced by C. Edmund Kells, in which he used a lead wire in a root canal to determine its length.
Do you know if that film is available any place?
No, I do not know.
Getting back to Dr. Hatton, this was an area that the focal infection era. I wonder if you could tell me how the whole feeling of the profession of the country, just the whole swept up era, affected you personally, what you were trying to do, patient acceptance, care, acceptance and results, things of that nature.
Well,
I'm glad I was able to get you relaxed enough so that you could put your notes away.
As you know, William Hunter gave a talk in Montreal in 1910 which demolished the dental profession as a whole and root canal treatment in particular. And it was about 30 years before the dental profession recovered from it altogether. What he said was that, in essence, many patients with all kinds of systemic diseases have these diseases as a result of oral sepsis. He was an English physician who did not see, could not have seen much of American dentistry. But nevertheless, he criticized severely American dentistry because it was the fountainhead for dentistry all over the world. And what he said was that as a result of this oral sepsis, these many, and he named perhaps 30 or 40 different diseases as examples, which are caused by infected teeth. Now, the interesting thing is this. In 1910, according to Howard Raper, R-A-P-E-R, the first radiologist, dental radiologist in this country, according to Howard Raper, who just died this past year, and I must say that I'm sorry he is gone. I visited him in Albuquerque, New Mexico, just about 2 years ago. Howard Raper said in an article that in 1910, there were only about a dozen dentists who had not x-ray machines, but x-ray coils, or coils, in other words, a not an accumulation, but put together pieces of apparatus by which one could take x-ray pictures of the teeth. So, under the circumstances, William Hunter did not base this condemnation of root canal treatment on facts. May interest you to know that, if I remember correctly, the first dental x-ray machine was a modification of a medical machine, and it came out in 1917. That's the commercial machine, came out in 1917. And when dentists began to buy machines, take radiographs, and see what horrible root canal treatment had been done without the use of the radiograph prior to that time, of course, and with areas of rarefaction present, then, of course, they jumped on the bandwagon of the focal infection theory. I would say that it was not until there was an accumulation of evidence by the medical profession somewhere into the 30s by Small at Massachusetts General Hospital by someone whose name with regard to rheumatic diseases, by someone whose name I don't recall at Johns Hopkins with regard to disease of the eye, which were often related to diseased teeth, etc., that we had a body of facts. facts accumulated, which seem to show that the presence of an area of rarefaction was apparently not related to one's health. In fact, Vasey and Clark Kennedy, V-A-I-Z-E-Y and Clark hyphen Kennedy, in England, gastroenterologists showed by a series, two series of cases. Number one, the removal of the teeth did not help the patient. Number two, in another series of cases, the removal of that patients became worse so far as their, forget what they call their the gastroenterologic problem, became worse after they had the teeth removed. So that it was not until the 40s when the dental profession began to bounce back, began to do scientific root canal treatment using the radiograph, of course. Could I have a drink?
Oh, sure. What
and
like?
Shall we turn it off in the meantime?
Okay.
Let me know when you're ready.
Okay.
So far as patient acceptance is concerned, yes, we had great difficulty at times. When we thought that root canal treatment should be done, the patient would say, but doctor, I'm going to have a dead tooth, am I not? And then we'd have to explain that tooth has two sources of nerve and blood supply. One of those will be gone, it's true, but the other will still be functioning. I still have to do that at times today. I say people have two kidneys, and one of them can be removed, or one lung can be removed, and they can still function. But we didn't have so much trouble with patients, perhaps, as we did with physicians. The ophthalmologist especially, and the rheumatologist, and the cardiologist. If there was some difficulty, particularly in the case of the ophthalmologist, if the patient had some condition which didn't respond to treatment, he was sure that it's due to an infected tooth. I remember well the argument I had with an ophthalmologist who sent a young person, maybe 18 years of age, to me because she had some sort of eye condition, I don't recall what. She had a perfect set of teeth. Radiographs were taken, disclosed nothing. All teeth pulp tested vitally. At that time, we did not use the kind of pulp tester we have today. It was a medical instrument with a primary and a secondary current. You moved a tube along a bar, and that increased the amount of current. If the patient didn't respond, you pulled out one of the wires and combined the primary and secondary current, and then again you started moving the tube along the bar. At any rate, she did have, at her age, roughly 18, she had four unerupted teeth, third molars. And so, of course, he had these four third molars removed. The condition didn't improve any. So she was sent back to me for another examination. What happened after that, I cannot tell you, but such was the milieu in medicine at the time that if a patient didn't respond to treatment, they just felt that it's got to be due to an infected tooth.
Were you looked upon in those days as sort of a renegade for pursuing endodontic treatment and encouraging it?
I suppose everyone was who taught, who lectured on endodontic treatment to some extent. There were some some with open minds, and shall I say there were enough with open minds. And in fact, I must tell you that an oral surgeon in our city, who had been opposed to endodontic treatment, when his son, who was an athlete, was hit in the mouth and fractured a lower anterior tooth, exposing the pulp, he sent him to me for endodontic treatment. But I must also mention that at a dental meeting, the oral surgeon had the largest room. The person who spoke on root canal treatment, because the term endodontics hadn't been coined as yet, the person who spoke on root canal treatment had a room just about the size of this room in the hotel, namely one that would hold about 20 people or 25, and that was it. And there were times, I remember one instance, there was a Dr. Morse, I think that was his name, an oral surgeon. And unfortunately, his lecture was right next door to mine, or clinic, I should say, right next door to mine. And he had standing room only. They were out partway into the hallway. And I had just about a dozen. You can imagine how I felt. But the tide has turned today.
It certainly has. I mentioned before that...
Moose was his name. Moose. I just remembered, yes.
I mentioned before that there were two centers of endodontics, Philadelphia and Michigan.
Right.
and the theory and the practice evolved along different concepts trying to get the same end result.
I don't think, in principle, I don't think we were very different. Ralph Summer was a person of great enthusiasm, and I'm sure that he, because of his great enthusiasm, inspired many of his students to practice endodontics, even during the focal infection era. He was also a person of great vitality and greatly devoted to endodontics. For example, he would hire a trailer if he were going to Canada to give a course. He would hire a trailer and bring his instruments and equipment and so on in this trailer. He was greatly devoted to endodontic treatment. At that time, he did a fair amount of surgical treatment. Our philosophy was to do as many cases as possible by conservative treatment, and I must confess the reason for it. The reason for it was that if a case required surgery, that had to be done by the oral surgical department. I used to take the patient down to the oral surgical department and watch the operation, and then take the patient back to the clinic. In my office, of course, whenever it was necessary to do surgery, I did it. But I could not give demonstrations in a periapical surgery until I'm not sure just when. But there came a certain point in development of the endodontic program which made it possible for me to actually give the demonstrations in periapical surgery. Our school, I think, was the very first one to have closed-circuit television. We were very fortunate in that one of our graduates founded CBS, and that's Dr. Leon Levy, and his brother founded the Columbia Broadcasting Company, and today it's known as CBS, of course. And he had provided us with equipment for closed-circuit television. I gave the first closed-circuit demonstration of root canal treatment and surgery. And I remember well that in this room, up until that time, by the way, I used to give demonstrations to 8 students from 9 to 12 every Friday morning until the entire class had had demonstrations. We had 8 bar chairs, 2 tiers, 1-4, a little bit lower than the other 4, and the students would watch. I encouraged our